Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 27th of April, these are our main stories. The US focuses on air defences for Ukraine, earmarking $6 billion of military aid in the war against Russia. UN investigators dismiss one case and suspend three others against employees from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, accused of involvement in the Hamas October the 7th attacks. And
a lot of the crops of farmers in parts of Afghanistan is actually rotting. So it is having a profound impact on people's livelihoods.
Climate change brings even more suffering to Taliban-run Afghanistan. Also in this podcast, King Charles is to resume some public duties while he continues his cancer treatment. And imagine running this marathon at the age of 76.
Day one, 31 kilometres. Day two, 40.8 kilometres. Day three was 85 kilometres. That was a tough day.
After a huge foreign aid bill was recently approved in Washington, the United States has announced details of where $6 billion of military aid on Ukraine will be spent. Despite pressure from Kiev, the package doesn't include new Patriot launchers. At the Pentagon, the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said rather than focusing too much on that, the goal should be to assist Ukraine in developing an effective missile defense system.
I would caution us all in terms of making Patriot the silver bullet. I would say that it's gonna be the integrated air and missile defense, as we've said so many times before, that really turns a tide. And so there are other capabilities that they need that we really pushed hard to get, and we may be able to get to the Ukrainians a bit faster. But this work continues on.
Our correspondent in Washington, Will Vernon, has more details about what this announcement means for Ukraine.
This is separate from that big major aid bill, the $61 billion that was passed by Congress a few days ago. This is an extra $6 billion the Pentagon has found basically down the back of the sofa. And it'll be used to buy kit, like weapons, ammunition, other equipment from US defense contractors and then sent to Ukraine. So it includes missiles for the Patriot system and also another air defense system called NASAMS and counter-drone systems too. And this will all come, as I say, from arms manufacturers here in the US. Now, that could take time, of course. Some of these weapons will need to be built and shipped. But one of the key parts of it is artillery ammunition. This is something Ukraine has been critically short of recently. The Ukrainians say Russia's been outgunning them on the battlefield by a ratio of 10 to 1. So for every 10 artillery shells the Russians have been firing, the Ukrainians have only had enough for one. And making the announcement today, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Charles Brown, he said this package, as well as the $61 billion supplemental that was passed a few days ago, they should eliminate that shell shortage very quickly indeed. So that's an important point. And this is a substantial amount of money, $6 billion. It's the largest the US has committed so far from this particular pot of money.
And I suppose interesting in how the Ukrainians will react, Will, is what is not in this package.
Yeah, so this announcement was made following a meeting of the so-called Ukraine Contact Group. So this is a grouping of around 50 countries who all support Ukraine. It includes every single NATO member country. And President Zelensky actually joined their meeting himself personally today and called again, said that Ukraine needs Patriot systems and not just initiatives. But he did thank the Americans. Lloyd Austin, the US Defense Secretary, you heard him just there, didn't you? He said he's been talking to European allies about providing more systems. And so he hopes additional capabilities will become available soon. So I think that'll be a big relief if that happens for the Ukrainians.
Will Vernon in Washington. The American Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the US is prepared to take steps against China if it continues to supply Russia with items used for its war in Ukraine. Antony Blinken was speaking to the BBC after talks with President Xi Jinping. Speaking to our China correspondent Laura Bicker, Mr. Blinken urged cooperation where possible, but said the US was not ducking from some of the things that divide China and the West. Let's hear some of the interview.
What we're focused on is maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. It's an interest of countries around the world. 50% of commercial container traffic goes through that strait every single day. 70% of the semiconductors that the world relies on for everything from dishwashers to cars to our iPhones made in Taiwan. So everyone has an interest in making sure that peace and stability is preserved. We've had a longstanding policy. It's a one China policy, but that also includes making sure that Taiwan has the ability to defend itself, and the assistance that we provide to them and provided them for decades is commensurate with the threat. That's actually a way of deterring. They may see it differently.
You came to ask Beijing to stop supplying Moscow with components that Russia is using in its invasion of Ukraine. You've asked them to do this before. What makes you think that they will listen to you this time?
Let's be clear about what's happening and what's not happening. What's not happening is provision of actual arms by China to Russia for use in Ukraine. And at the very start of Russia's aggression, we made clear to China that that was unacceptable, and we've not seen them do that. But what China is doing, or what some of its enterprises are doing, is to provide critical components for Russia's defense industrial base. Machine tools, microelectronics, and optics. Those are being used to help Russia on what's an extraordinary crash course effort to make more munitions, tanks, armored vehicles, missiles. The actions that Russia has taken are going at a pace unlike any we've seen in its modern history, including the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And this could not be happening without the support that China's providing. It's helping Russia perpetuate its aggression against Ukraine, but it's also creating a growing threat to Europe because of Russia's aggression. And what I'm hearing from Europeans is deep concern about this. So for China, if it wants to have better relations, not only with us, but with countries in Europe, it can't do that while at the same time helping to fuel the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. We've taken action already against Chinese entities that are engaged in this. What I made clear today is that if China won't act, we will.
What will those actions involve?
I'm not going to get into the details except to say, look at what we've done already. We've imposed sanctions, export controls on more than 100 Chinese entities because of their involvement in helping Russia with its defense industrial base. And we're fully prepared to take further action.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton gave me her assessment of the meeting.
Antony Blinken was unusually harsh, I thought, considering he was actually in the Chinese capital when he was making his remarks, basically accusing Beijing of fueling the war in Ukraine, not by supplying outright weapons, but what Beijing is doing, according to the Americans, is supplying a lot of dual-use components and technology, which the Russians are then using to fashion into weapons that they're using against the Ukrainians. The Chinese position on this is basically to accuse Washington of being completely hypocritical by saying, look, you have just signed a $61 billion package that hands weapons to the Israelis, to Taiwan, that actually $8 billion of that package is going to give weapons to counter China's rise in the region. And so they would say, you're handing weapons out right, left and center. What's the issue?
What do you make of the general tone between these two men? And I suppose we should ask general relations between the United States and China.
Well, the relationship has improved a lot since August 2022, when the then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi traveled to Taiwan. That put relations in a deep freeze. They went even to a lower point, I would say, after the United States took down a suspected Chinese surveillance balloon just a few months after that. The two sides are really rebuilding their relationship right now, but I would say that they're frenemies. They have accepted that they need each other to solve many of their key problems, whether it comes to trade issues in the Middle East, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, they can't do without each other. And so they have to find a way to work together. And that was the tone of a lot of the remarks that we've heard publicly from Antony Blinken and also from Xi Jinping. I mean, Xi Jinping, frankly, was quite poetic in his remarks today. So, for example, he says, "Today, as I see it, dwellers of the same planet should help each other. We live in an interdependent world and rise and fall together." I mean, he just emphasized over and over again how he wants the relationship to stabilize. So the relationship has stabilized, but they both have their red lines. It's the provision of help to Russia for the United States, and it's the issue of Taiwan for China.
Celia Hatton. There's been a development in an investigation into Israeli allegations against the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The agency, UNRWA, was embroiled in controversy in January when the Israelis said a dozen employees had been involved in the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. It caused many countries to pull their funding. Well, now UN investigators have closed one case and suspended three others. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher has been telling me more.
What has been announced today by the UN spokesperson is that one of those cases has been closed because essentially they said that they'd not received any evidence from Israel that backed up the allegations. They closed it. Three others have been suspended, saying only insufficient information has been received from Israel. So it's impossible to carry out a full investigation at the moment. The other cases are being investigated. But if you go back to when Israel made these accusations back in January, and this is where it gets a bit murky because it's unclear exactly where we are with this, but UNRWA fired 10 of those 12 staff immediately, and they said the remaining two were dead. So presumably the implication of this is that even the two who are dead are still being investigated as to whether they did have direct involvement in the October 7th attacks.
Has Israel had anything to say about these interim findings?
I mean, Israel's position is that it's not just UNRWA, it sees the UN as well as essentially being an entity that is predisposed against Israel. So it would dismiss reports that are being issued by UN investigators as, again, part of that bias.
Seb, where are we with funding of various countries for UNRWA? We know a number of nations had pulled money from supporting this agency.
UNRWA depends on having funding from foreign donors. I think around half of the funding it gets is from the US. And the US was one of the countries that immediately suspended all its funds to UNRWA. Now, there hasn't been a change as yet from the US. There hasn't been a change from the UK. But we have seen Germany just in the last couple of days has said that it will resume funding. We've seen that with several other countries as well. That will not get anywhere close to the sort of funding that UNRWA needs in order to provide the needs not just of the refugees in Gaza, but in the occupied West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria and in Jordan.
Sebastian Usher there. Should medically assisted dying be made legal and for whom? It's a question being intensely debated in several countries at the moment. In Canada, medical assistance in dying, or MAID, is already allowed for adults with a terminal illness or serious and chronic medical conditions. But the government there has also been considering whether to extend it to people who suffer solely from a mental illness that sparked a fierce debate. And this year, the government decided to delay. The BBC's Nadine Youssef has been following the case of one man considering applying to end his own life for the past year. And a warning that this report coming up does contain references to severe mental suffering, which some of you might find distressing.
John Scully has a familiar daily routine, rifling through his medicine cabinet with his wife, Tony.
I take 30 pills a day, 30. That's to deal with other physical and mental problems. I've had 19 shock therapies. It did no good, but God knows what harm it did.
John suffers from severe mental illness. He has depression, anxiety, and severe PTSD following years of work as a journalist covering conflicts, including Sarajevo and the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Rioters gathered and began to throw stones at the police. The police understandably retaliated.
Fear is good, it's healthy. If you're not frightened, you get killed. But I was thinking that I have to control the fear, be calm, and go ahead and get the story. I started bouncing around from war zone to war zone. and I steal to myself all the time. I paid a huge price for it. I suffer from somatic pain, chronic pain. That means pain that they can't diagnose and assume it's psychiatric. I've been in this condition for roughly 40 years.
After a lifetime of what he describes as intolerable suffering in various therapies or treatment, he's fighting for the right to apply for a medically assisted death. Canada was planning to introduce medically assisted dying for those solely suffering from mental illness in March 2024. But the controversial debate around whether Canada is ready, or ever will be, has been rife. And in January, the Canadian government chose to delay by 3 years to 2027, saying the country needed more time. The medical community in Canada remains divided on this. Dr. Sonu Gand is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto and a former president of the Canadian Psychiatric Society. He is concerned that allowing assisted death solely for mental illness could be dangerous.
All the evidence shows us that when we attempt to make predictions of irremediability in mental illness, we are wrong more than half the time. And I can think in my own practice of a number of people who struggled for a long time. We tried various things. They didn't get better for a long time. And then they did.
Dr. Chantal Perrault has been a MAID assessor and provider since 2016, when it was first introduced in Canada. She supports the expansion and for those suffering irremediably to have the right to be assessed.
Can people with these disorders live and enjoy life? Absolutely. But some cannot. And again, it's those few people who are suffering intolerably who deserve the right to be assessed for MAID. I think a lot of people don't understand just how debilitating it can be to live with a mental disorder.
The government says this delay is essential to make sure any expansion would be safely and adequately provided. But with the general election expected by October next year, advocates are concerned this three-year delay could be extended if a different party is elected.
Nadine Youssef with that report. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
There were a lot of women coming to us, not because they were religious, but because they were postpartum and they didn't want cutouts in their gowns anymore. Or they were working in professional environments and they just couldn't find clothes that suited them for that.
The astronomical rise of modest fashion. King Charles is to return to some public duties, including hosting the Emperor and Empress of Japan. After he responded positively to cancer treatment, he's been receiving care as an outpatient since early February after being diagnosed with an unspecified form of the disease. It was detected during treatment for an unrelated enlarged prostate. Buckingham Palace has released a photograph of the King and Queen. Here's Charlotte Gallagher.
The photo, which shows the King and Queen in the gardens of Buckingham Palace, is being seen as a positive sign about the monarch's health. The palace says the King is making encouraging progress and will shortly return to public-facing duties after a period of treatment and recuperation. It adds the royal couple are deeply grateful for the many kindnesses and good wishes they have received from around the world. The King's last public appearance was in Windsor on Easter Sunday, and he surprised the crowds by stopping to chat. His next visit will be, fittingly, to a cancer treatment centre. There is no news about when the Princess of Wales will return to public duties. She announced her cancer diagnosis in March and has asked for time, space and privacy for herself and her family.
Charlotte Gallagher. The authorities in Kenya say the number of people killed in severe flooding has risen to 70. Kenya and other countries in East Africa, a region highly vulnerable to climate change, have seen heavier than usual rainfall in recent weeks, exacerbated by the El Nino weather pattern. At least 150 people have died in neighbouring Tanzania. Richard Hamilton reports.
Kenyans have been warned to stay on high alert, with more heavy rain forecast across the country as the monsoon continues to batter East Africa. The extreme weather has caused chaos in the capital, Nairobi, this week, blocking roads and engulfing homes in slum districts. On Thursday, the Tanzanian Prime Minister, Kassim Majaliwa, said more than 200,000 people had been affected by the disaster and that homes, property, crops, schools and infrastructure had either been damaged or destroyed. In Burundi, nearly 100,000 people have been displaced by the months of relentless rain. And earlier this week, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Agency, OCHA, said rains were intensifying in Somalia, with flash floods reported in recent days. Uganda has also suffered heavy storms that have caused riverbanks to burst, with several hundred villagers displaced.
That was Richard Hamilton. When it comes to the problems Afghanistan is facing, climate change doesn't immediately spring to mind. But the country is actually one of the most vulnerable. Afghanistan has been largely isolated by the international community since the Taliban regained control and reintroduced extremely harsh restrictions on women and girls' rights and freedoms. But this week, international agencies held the first talks there about climate change, co-hosted by the Norwegian Afghanistan Committee. Its director, Terje Vatterdal, told James Menendez about Afghanistan's plight.
It is one of the most vulnerable countries. I think it's ranked number 6 internationally, and it's the country that is the least prepared for the impact of climate change. Just as an example, today it has been raining heavily. Tomorrow we are expecting 34 millimeters of rain. This is not common in April. This is actually the beginning of harvest season. So a lot of the crops of farmers in parts of Afghanistan is actually rotting. So it is having a profound impact on people's livelihoods.
And people are already at rock bottom, particularly when it comes to access to food, aren't they?
They are. Both the change of government back in August 2021, the following sanctions from the international community, the war on Ukraine, which has led to increased food prices. And then on top of that, you have changing weather patterns. So this is a dire situation for the Afghan people. For example, in one of the northern provinces where we work, in Badakhshan, it's one of the provinces that are most vulnerable to natural disasters. And of course, when heavy rain is coming, like now, the soil up there is finer than sand. And with the heavy rain at this time of the year, it leads to massive landslides, to erosion along little brooks and big rivers, rock falls. So about 10% of the arable land in Badakhshan disappears every single year. So Afghanistan is really at the brink of, in many ways, an environmental collapse. In parts of the country, since 1950, there has been an increase in temperature of more than 2.5 degrees Celsius. Afghanistan is really extremely vulnerable to climate change, more than most other countries in Asia.
Given all that, how seriously do Taliban officials take the threat?
I think the symposium that we had earlier this week was a proof of the government actually taking it seriously. When I came here about 10 years ago, we could dig 50 metres and we would find water. Now it's down to more than 200 metres. So they're very much aware of the impact of climate change. So I do feel that they are taking it seriously. In the past, they would say, well, this is God's will. Now it is much more the discussion that, okay, we are not really appreciating the earth and this is why we are being punished. So I do feel there has been a change. And that is good because action is necessary now. Afghanistan is contributing with 0.06% of greenhouse gas emissions. So the problems come to Afghanistan from outside. So I think it's nothing but fair that the international community supports through UN agencies, through technical assistance to the technical agencies under the government, but also through international and national NGOs. But they can definitely not manage this by themselves.
Terje Vatterdal there of the Norwegian Afghanistan Committee in Kabul. Now, thousands of models, designers and buyers have descended on Istanbul in Turkey for Modest Fashion Week. Valued at hundreds of billions of dollars, modest fashion is a booming sector as more women look to cover up for religious or personal reasons but still want to stay on trend. The BBC's Megan Lawton reports on the brands that are looking to cash in.
Once associated with flowing abayas and floor-length kaftans, modest fashion is changing. In this video from last year, models are wearing leather skirts, cowboy hats and feather boas. For Modest Fashion Week founder Özlem Sahin Ertas, it's important her runways reflect the evolution of the style.
For us, the modesty is not related to any
social, religious or cultural background.
According to the recent State of the Global Islamic Economy report by research firm Dyna Standard, Muslim spend on clothing in 2022 was $318 billion. That's a rise of 8.4% compared to the previous year.
I think we just had a really rapid growth within the Gen Z and within the Western world.
Maha Gondal is a modest fashion content creator who was born in Pakistan but grew up in Toronto in Canada. She has over 180,000 followers on TikTok and has worked with brands including Coach, Tiffany & Co. and Versace.
Hi guys, let's get ready with me for tonight using a full burqa.
One of the reasons the industry has grown so rapidly is social media. The hashtag modest has had 7.2 billion views on TikTok.
I had little girls, they would reach out and be like, oh my God, you're the first brown girl from within our community who we can actually look up to. When I first moved to Canada, I didn't see a Muslim girl, let alone a brown girl on a billboard. But now you're able to see that.
Modest fashion is gaining popularity with women from all backgrounds. The Reflective are an e-commerce website for modest dressing women. They're based in New York and have customers who are Jewish, Muslim and Christian, but also women from non-faith backgrounds. It's run by Ariella Immerman and Liza Hockeen.
There were a lot of women coming to us, not because they were religious, but because they were postpartum and they didn't want cutouts in their gowns anymore. Or they were working in professional environments and they just couldn't find clothes that suited them for that.
Ariella also highlights the current trend of old money, a style gaining popularity thanks to celebrities like Sophia Richie.
10 tips to creating that old money style.
Instead of flashy logos and bold prints, this style is about embracing classic wardrobe staples.
That whole classy, almost timeless luxury style goes hand in hand with modest fashion as well.
The State of the Global Islamic Economy report estimates the global modest fashion industry will grow to $428 billion by 2027.
Megan Lawton reporting, and you can hear more by searching for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now at 254 kilometres, the Marathon des Sables in Morocco is the equivalent of running six marathons over 7 days in temperatures that can exceed 50 degrees Celsius. So imagine it, climbing and descending through the rolling sand dunes of the Sahara while carrying the food and supplies you need for the day. It's described as the toughest of the foot races, and even those in the prime of life have found it too much to bear. So spare a thought for Harry Hunter, who has just become the oldest Briton to complete the race at the age of 76, raising money for a children's hospice. He told Julian Marshall why he took on such a gruelling challenge.
I have been doing these sort of races for about 10 years anyway, and I did a lot of racing, ultras and marathons and everything before that. This one, the iconic one, it's the original one, because I knew that if I finished, I'd be the oldest British finisher in the history of the race.
How long did it take you?
It was about 54 hours. There was 860 whoever started the race. But I finished 508th, and my bib number was 508, which is spooky, really.
And were there moments when you thought you wouldn't make it?
No, a lot of experience. It's tough. They classify it the toughest foot race on the planet. You only eat what you've got on your back, and all they give you throughout the race is water. And at night, you go back into this bivouac area and you have somewhere you can sleep, but you still have to carry all your sleeping kit. And basically, it was day one, 31 kilometres. Day two, 40.8 kilometres. Day three was 85 kilometres. That was a tough day. I was out on the ground for over 22 hours.
Goodness.
And then the fourth day of running, just plus 43 kilometres. And then the next day was 31 again, and the last day was 21 kilometres.
And what was the terrain like?
Sand dunes, jebels, climbs, a lot of sand everywhere. It's stunning. There's nothing. In the whole time I was running, I've seen, I think, four wild camels and some animals I thought might have been goats with long legs, but I wasn't sure from the distance. I don't know what they were. And just beetles that run through the sand. You look at it and think, well, this is a place where if you went wrong, you're not going to come out of it because there's just nothing there. There's no water. There's no anything.
Were you running on your own or...?
Well, no, it sets off. You're running with other people. Sometimes you can be on your own, but you can see people in front of you and there's people behind. You follow markers and they can pull you out at any time. They're checking you all the time, make sure you're not going to kill yourself.
I mean, when you reach your age, I mean, the medical advice is to avoid high-impact exercise. Mm. Your knees start to go, your hips start to go, but that hasn't been happening to you.
Not at all. I'm a very lucky man. So I am. I mean, I'm not sort of trying to blow my own trumpet, but I do believe that I'm a lot fitter than possibly people who are a lot younger than me.
And so the secret is just to keep going, is it?
Always, yes. Never stop. I've been doing a lot of this for a lot of my life. I mean, I hope in 4 years' time I'm 80, I'll still be there. I don't see any reason why not. I still go to the gym, I still work hard, I still run. That's what I want to carry on doing.
And well done to him. That's Harry Hunter, the oldest Briton to complete the Marathon des Sables, or Marathon of the Sands. Mike Pinder, the last surviving founding member of the English rock band The Moody Blues, has died at the age of 82. Pinder, who played the keyboard, helped form the group in Birmingham in the mid-1960s. They went on to reach the top of the charts three times in the UK and twice in the US. Our culture correspondent, Lizo Mazimba, looks back at the life of the Mellotron Man.
Mike Pinder's piano introduction to the Moody Blues' first hit, Go Now, a number one in 1964. But it was his introduction of a new instrument, the mellotron, that gave the band its unique sound. Pressing keys on its keyboard triggered the playing of pre-recorded audio tape. It was often described as a keyboard with the power of an orchestra, but with an otherworldly quality. Beauty I'd always miss with these eyes before. Mike Pinder first came across the mellotron when he answered an advert from an electronics firm looking for someone to help with the new invention.
I said, I'm your man, you know. I started working with them, went through the whole process of how the mellotron was built, its conception and everything, and then ended up being the tester so that when the machines came off the line, I would thoroughly go through the machine, play it, things like that.
Pinder used the mellotron extensively on the band's early albums, and he inspired its use by others, recommending it to John Lennon and Paul McCartney, who used it on the song Strawberry Fields Forever. Pinder left the Moody Blues in the late 1970s, but he was instrumental in giving the band a 60s dreamy psychedelic sound that was copied by so many.
Lizo Mazimba on the life of Mike Pinder from the Moody Blues, who has died at the age of 82. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.